Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, as though he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like, what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Badge Epic Ensemble is a remarkable musical force based in Toronto, Ontario, led in spirit and word and deed by the gifted multi-instrumentalist and producer Max Turnbull. Badge recently released an excellent new album called Self Help, which features guest vocals by the likes of Meg Remy of US Girls, Jennifer Castle, Dorothea Paz, and James Bailey, among others. Self Help is now for sale via Telephone Explosion Records, and Max and I connected recently for an extensive chat about this band and where they came from. Local politics, the definition of dank, the internet's never-ending present, meditation and self-help, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Jennifer Castle, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 582nd episode of Creative Control, featuring the beautiful and talented Max Turnbull of Badge Epic Ensemble, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Max. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm not bad. Thanks for asking. As always, I think I know where you are, but I always like to ask my guests, you know, where in the world they are. Mm-hmm. Where in the world are you today, Max?
I'm in Etobicoke, Ontario, at home, in my music room.
Oh, nice. How are things going in Etobicoke these days, given everything that's happening? As we're speaking, it is November 5th. So I don't know if you've been following the American election. I feel like everything else in my information processing life has been put on hold as I try to suss out what's going on there. Is that the case for you?
To a bit of a degree. I will say about Etobicoke, it's a little quieter in this neighborhood since Doug Ford passed, who was a bit of a canary in the coal mine for the stuff happening down south. So
that you mean Rob Ford? Bit.
Say it again.
Rob Ford passed. Did Doug Ford die?
That was a Freudian slip right there.
Oh, man. Isn't it weird? We're getting a little harsh in our goodwill towards people. I've seen it on the social media. People hoping other people get sick and die, you know? It's a weird... But maybe... Is it just... I don't know how to frame it. Is it somewhat justified to have these feelings?
Oh, man. That's a question that's above... my pay grade, for sure. I think that there's a kind of a crudity in politics that, you know, seems to call for that kind of interactive mode that's very cynical. And I think part of that, too, is just letting off some steam. So anything that takes place online, I just heavily discount from, you know, what happens sort of in front of one's senses in person.
Yeah, I think that, but when people are jerks, it does, and if you don't feel like you're a jerk and someone is just obviously a jerk, it turns you into a bit of a jerk towards them, is basically where I'm coming from. You kind of, my wife has said it a few times, like, you know, and I'm like, oh, I think, where's Mike Pence been? Maybe he got the thing. And she'll be like, you know, kind of under her breath, but she'll say, good. I'm like, geez, is that really what you want? You want people to... Is that where we're at? But then at the same time, you think of all the human life and suffering that have been caused by these individuals. And yeah, this whole conversation has taken a very dark tone.
Yeah.
And I'm worried that the authorities might be listening. So all this to say, Etobicoke is quiet since Rob Ford has left. And is it quiet otherwise in Toronto because of the pandemic? Or is it business as usual, per se?
It seemed... relative, you know, not nearly as quiet as March and April, where driving on the Gardiner Expressway felt sort of like being in a zombie movie or something, you know, seeing the messaging that was happening from municipal authorities. Just it's such an odd experience being like an urban denizen and being told on public messaging and billboards to stay at home. You know, I think that was sort of a bizarre experience, but you know, from the spring through summer, it felt kind of back to hustling and bustling as a city may. And I find that there hasn't really been that much diminishment despite the numbers crawling back up. in how active the city feels. I mean, that's just like on a walking down the street getting groceries kind of analysis, not so much to do with like any cultural city stuff, which feels a little dormant, especially for someone who doesn't participate in too much of the Zoom streaming stuff, because I know a lot of the cultural stuff has just migrated there, but I just don't have that much of an affinity for that mode of conveying music and the other things that I would normally be participating in a city. So,
well, you and I have done a few interviews over the past 7 years, and I've also interviewed your wife, Meg Remy. And one of the things that always sticks out for me is that in every instance that we've spoken, it has come up that you don't have the internet at home, at your home. Is that still the case? Do you not have Wi-Fi or anything like that?
It's very specifically true to say we don't have Wi-Fi. It would be untrue to say that we don't have access to the internet at home. You know, I have I have an iPhone. I'm speaking to you on an iPhone. So I partake
of that.
You have
a data plan of some kind?
Yeah, exactly. We have a data plan and able to tether to the phone to like check email and this kind of thing. But we've found just it's kind of a nice balance having access to the internet whenever we need it, but not so much that you kind of spiral into like a YouTube wormhole at 1 a.m. Even just like this, I find that there's a kind of a Netflixification of everything where just all kind of cultural curation has been migrated to the internet. So just having to make things a little more difficult, like having to make use of the library for reading material and getting new DVDs and stuff like that, just seems to keep us infused with a varied perspective. So yeah, I'm conscious that it sounds like a flex, like, oh, we don't have internet at home. It's not true. And, but we do, you know, I think the sort of self-regulation thing is crucial, and it's very difficult. So if there is Wi-Fi at home, I suspect that the internet consumption would look just like anyone else's, really.
Well, I only bring it up. I appreciate what you're saying saying about it being a flex, because people used to say and still say, I don't watch TV. You know, I don't consume media. But the internet thing is, I think your decision making, it was always kind of admirable to me, frankly, and vaguely like novel to know that, you know, I couldn't have a Skype conversation. Yeah. Or whatnot with you or Meg. I mean, every interview, I did an interview with Meg about the most recent U.S. Girls record. And prior to that, every time we'd done interviews, we met in person at Jules Cafe. I think you and I, we've talked mostly either on the phone or I think you've, in the past, you've gone to like your parents' house so you could connect to the internet. So all this to say, like I bring it up only because I think you're right to have that self-discipline to say, you know what? We don't need all that stuff, and you might be better off, because for those of us who are always connected, it is a little stressful. It is a little stressful to try to feel like you're always not only informed, but maybe more informed than someone else. I don't know. It's a weird pressure we put on ourselves, and you have, in a weird way, you have kind of disconnected from that whole manner of thinking, and I think that's, I mean, it's probably annoying to some of your friends who are trying to email you or reach you or whatever using normal, but you've got the thing. So anyway, it's probably fine. All I'm saying is behaviorally, it's good. You're probably in a healthier state, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely feel that the mental health is greatly impacted by how much of the sort of internet stream we allow into our bloodstream or something like that. And I think that there may well be a shift in the culture at some point where it's actually some like symptom of a privilege, you know, the degree to which you are unexposed to the internet. You know, I think we may see the elite class sort of make use of that as a privilege, you know, not having to be as reliant and dependent on internet access as someone, say, who is like a member of the gig economy workforce or something like that, who's completely tethered to their phone all day, every day. So I don't know. At present, I'm not a member of that elite class. So,
yeah.
It's more just like a sort of lifestyle and mental health decision, but self-moderation.
Well, your album is called Self-Help, which I want to get to because I feel like that's a pretty interesting and empathetic, but probably loaded term at this point as well. But I just wanted to double back a little bit on what you were saying about classism and internet access, because, again, as we're speaking, it's November 5th. And as we're speaking, the United States of America doesn't have a president because the race is too close. And some of the discourse around that is about, you know, a lot of people are like, how is this even close? What is going on with half the country that they think the information that they trust and have been sort of given is viable or something you can believe in? Do you think internet access? I don't know this to be the case, because obviously conspiracy theories, QAnon, all these things are internet based. However, there is this sort of, and I'm curious because I think of you as a very thoughtful guy. I'm just curious what you think of this. A lot of the kind of analysis of what's going on about the way that country is divided, and it happens in Canada as well, is that a certain populace is more informed than the other. But we're now at a point where both sides would say, no, I'm informed. My main source is blank. And that, depending on the what side of the spectrum you're on, you'd be like, well, that, you know, the Globe and Mail is garbage. Someone else might say, oh, you know, the Rebel in Canada or Breitbart is garbage. So we're in this information divide. And I just, as someone who has chosen purposely to try to figure out how much information you're going to engage with by how connected you are to the internet, there's some going on there too, don't you think? Like, isn't information important and accurate information important and access to it?
I think so, but I think that the most important information is that which is perceived in sort of the immediacy of your corporeal existence, like what you're looking at directly in front of your eyes, what you're hearing, you know, in the room that you're in. I think that information is the most important information. And my fear is just that even that sort of basic humane sort of information reception is being mediated at all times by, you know, the devices and the social media and whatever, you know, however you want to classify the sort of technological stuff that we're all just so hooked up to. And I'm certainly a part of that. I don't see myself as above it, but I'm conscious of it and try to just mediate my exposure to it. And yeah, I don't know. I think this sort of constant mediation of all modes of thinking sort of precludes a thoughtfulness that when engaged with, we sort of are able to see people as fellow humans. And I don't know. I just think if you spend, if you had to spend a week at a weekend at a cottage with someone who you saw through their social media feed was like ideologically opposed to you, or your, what you carry around is thinking to as your ideology, I think if you had to spend a weekend with that person, you would probably find a lot of moments of commonality and humanity in that experience. But it's sort of precluded by everyone kind of communicating through this technological way at this point.
Well, do you think there's a falseness to assuming that being informed and connected to the wider and broader world is going to enable you to impact that? Because I, as you were speaking about immediacy and the things in front of you, I was thinking about the recent interview that David Letterman conducted with Dave Chappelle. And I don't know, given your internet access, if you had a chance to watch that but or have any interest in watching it. But there's a section where Dave, the two Daves are strolling within Dave Chappelle's small community in Ohio. And he goes on an extended sort of dialogue about how his father, Dave Chappelle's father, imparted within him this notion that the most important thing you can impact for the greater good is your own community.
Yes.
Is to actually affect change hyper-locally, because if enough of that goes, and that is really the most important thing, because if your immediate community where you live, where you dwell, is in a place that it gets to a place where people are living harmoniously and understand each other and know each other and don't bother each other or or judge each other, that can have this remarkable domino effect if every community kind of thinks of it as like, we're going to be concerned about this. It's not that the other things, other communities around the world don't matter.
No.
But in terms of just being able to function in a healthy way, you need to have a strong base where you live. And so is that a little bit of what you're getting at there with what you were saying?
Yeah, for sure. For me personally, I think the most radical thing that I can do is try to have a radical kindness for the people that I encounter immediately, whether that's my family, my friends, mm-hmm. people on the street. You know, I think it's important to keep that as a constant reminder to try to be kind to people. It's difficult because, you know, the internet is so polarized and there's people who appear to be acting so monstrously on the internet. I think that's mostly a diversion from the sort of monstrous behavior of the sort of more elite ruling class. And I think a lot of the other stuff is a bit of a diversion from that. But I tend to agree. I think kindness within your community is the most important thing that you can do. And I think it's the only thing you can truly control. The rest is sort of like to keep you occupied and keep you spinning your wheels and trying to impact things that really we don't have any control over. You know, I think like in the last couple of days, everyone is checking their phones like once every 15 minutes to see if this election has been announced or something. And I think that expenditure of energy really has no impact on that result in particular as one instance. But it's certainly occupying a lot of mental energy that's just sort of being expended to little resource or purpose, in my opinion.
I just wonder if it's an illusion or not that that election will impact the greater our world, our communities. I feel like it will. I feel so. That's my thing. I'm keeping tabs on it because I don't believe that Joe Biden becoming president is going to have any kind of instantaneous change on the way we're all living. But I also think that it's on a symbolic level, it will. I think it will dial back some of the anti-science rhetoric around this pandemic we're all enduring. I really do, because I think there will be, for better or for worse, and often it is for the worse, we do look to that. The world looks to that country to lead us. And so as a tone setter, and I do think that when you have a maniac who is in charge of that country, whatever the breed of maniac that is, there have been many maniacs in charge of that country. But when you have one that's this overt, it has a ripple effect. We all, don't you feel a little stressed out that that guy's in charge? I do. I don't live there. I don't live in that country. But a lot of my friends do.
Yeah.
And we're right next door. Yeah. And I feel like tonally, it has enabled lying to an extent we may never. Like, it is basically legitimized and normalized a form of projection and lying and the treatment of others that I think will take decades to undo. Like, you and I are at an age where I think we move past this relatively easily, but we think about my kids and the kids that are being raised in this environment. My son keeps giving me election updates. Now, between you and me, I know the information. He's telling me old news. He doesn't know. He's not on top of this. I am. But vote counts in Georgia and this and that. I know what's going on, I say to my son. Anyway, don't you think a shift there would be better for all of us? Like, just mentally, just thinking about this? Or am I a slave to mass media by even worrying about this?
I think a shift in that at that level of politics can change the world, certainly, but the shift for me would be completely reimagining that, you know, our civic duty is to show up once a year. You know, I'm making an analog to Canada,
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
Here. And vote, and that's kind of it. And then the rest is a gamble. I think that level of power just shouldn't exist and needs to be interrogated as to why we are still subject to it, despite the fact that I think there's a consensus among all political stripes
yeah.
that it's yeah. not working.
Okay. Yeah. It's
so I don't know. I don't know if my political analysis is exactly what people are coming to this podcast for, but
no, it is. It's absolutely why I mean, your record is called Self Help. Your name has like your band's name is sort of French. You seem smart. I think on the surface, superficially, people will see all that language and be like, oh, I'm going to learn some things from this. It's going to be enlightened and interesting. You and I don't
it's
think...
It's a ruse.
It's a ruse. I don't think you and I have had an on-the-record conversation yet about this particular project. I know we... I think the last time you were on the show, we talked about Darlene Shrug, and I think you've been on for some of your other work as well. First of all, as you may know, I'm a big fan of this ensemble. What is this ensemble, first of all, Max? Tell us about it.
Well, it's a project that's sort of been developing slowly since, I think, late 2016 or thereabouts. Something that's just sort of marinating in the background of a lot of other projects that I was involved with, finding its identity. And, you know, when that's the albums that we've released so far have kind of been a record of that identity search. For me personally, on the level of just being a writer and having some ideas about arranging music and being interested in production and that kind of thing. And then I think slowly the theme that's sort of overtaking that one is the identity of the group as a sort of living organism of, at this point, seven musicians and a couple other engineer producers who have contributed to everything that we've done, that being Steve Cholley and Tony Price. Mm-hmm. And I think the story of this latest record is that this group has a chemistry and a sort of life force to it that can be captured when we're in the studio recording live music together. You know, almost everything that we've released so far has been almost a complete take with not too many overdubs recorded live in a studio. And I think that's becoming a major part of the identity of the group in large part.
So it's very much in the moment, sort of at least trusting those moments in terms of that live off the floor feel. How much of this is improvisation? How much of this is more composition? Can you speak to that?
On my part, it's very little improvisation. I think what's maybe interesting or unique about the structure of the group is that I am technically speaking a very naive musician, but I have sort of grand ideas about composition. And so I try to communicate those ideas through my sort of naive playing and then have hired people who are really crack musicians to flesh that out. So there are people in the group who do improvise quite a bit. Alia O'Brien, our flautist, being one, Ed Squires, our percussionist, being another. You know, from take to take, you'll get very different sort of interpretations from both of them. And then other people like Jay Anderson, the drummer, and myself are kind of playing fairly arranged parts.
Right.
And that's generally with the last album, Self-Help, how a lot of the material was developed was I would come up with some, maybe 3 to 4 little motifs musically that I thought, let's string these into a song, come up with a rough arrangement with Jay so that the kicks and the snares were falling in the right place, so to speak. And then over the course of a weekend, on the Saturday, we'd get everyone in the same room, run through the ideas and come up with a cohesive structure and arrangement together, and then the next day record it. So it's less that it's very improvised and more that it's spontaneous, I would say, is perhaps a better descriptor of it.
Spontaneous. Yeah. Okay, right. So you've assembled a group of players and you trust them, but there is a foundational aspect, an arrangement to the composition. It's just they can kind of, improvise or change things. They can change if they need to change. If they feel like they want to do something different than they did the last take, they go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm trying to conceive of my role as the band leader and primary writer. I say primary because Chris Bazant, our guitar player, also contributes some melodies and things like that. I sort of see my position as the band leader as that sort of like Homer gif where he's receding back into the bush a little bit, where I have certain ideas about the moods that I want to evoke with the music. And once I feel that that has sort of been instilled in the environment where we're creating a new song, then I try to recede a little bit and allow people to do their thing.
You had mentioned earlier that, you know, this was a project that came to being and has kind of found its own place in your own, I guess, creative trajectory Can you speak about that evolution a little bit in terms of self-help? Like the things you've just described and the modes of operating and the mm-hmm. the processes, how does that sort of work and those approaches, how does that differ from maybe when it first began? Can you speak to that? I'm just curious about that because when you have an exciting band like this one, I know you know, you might have a couple of gatherings and it'll seem good, but then you'll just hit your stride together and you'll be like, oh, okay, no, this is magical. So yeah. I guess I'm just curious about that first discovery of that magical feeling and mm-hmm. how that's translated into the work on self-help. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think at the beginning of this thing, I sort of had a conception of wanting to do music that was really moody, mood being the sort of emphasis of what I wanted to pursue. So having less of a kind of like, less of the ideological agenda of rock and roll, you know, which I think is very keen. It's sort of like a propagandistic form, like the imagery is such a huge part of it. And the lyrical content is like very ideological, whereas other forms of music like jazz and film music, which are sort of primary inspirations for this project, are a lot more open-ended and just you kind of set some energy in motion and people receive it in a way that's sort of personal. You know, like it can sound dark or it can sound happy, but beyond that, people attribute the minutiae of emotion in more of a particularized way. So that was the conception of it from the beginning, what okay. I wanted to do. And very slowly I started acquiring musicians, literally one by one. You know, it started as just Jay Anderson and I, and it was that for like close to a year. And then it became Jay and my brother-in-law, Josh, on bass. And it was that for a couple months. And then I always knew I wanted flute. I always knew flute was going to be the lead instrument. And the first record was kind of with that in mind, like, let's make a flute record that's really moody. And the chemistry was apparent from the very first practice, where everyone who's on that first record was in a jam space in the East End of Toronto. And, you know, we added, I think Ed was last, the percussionist on congas. And Jay was the only person who knew Ed in the band before anyone else. But Ed came in, characteristically cracked a beer, sat down with his congas, and we basically just played the first record as it sounds. And I just knew from that moment, wow, this is something special. There's a chemistry here that's evocative. And I think with that first record, I was kind of hitting my stride as an instrumental composer. And then the second record, the evolution has been maybe less of the emphasis of my being the band leader and the writer and the this and the that, and more just being in a studio and letting the experience of what we sound like as seven individuals in a room, as we added Karen Ng on saxophone with this latest record, being the seventh member, what we sound like in a room together. And that's really the story of this latest record.
Now, you've invoked jazz there, and to my reckoning, jazz is, it can be almost anything. And I know, I think, based on previous conversations we've had, based on how much of your music I've followed over, God, the last, I don't know, 10, 12 years, whatever it's been, 15 years, I can't mm-hmm. remember. You are someone that defies easy categorization, though I know that in terms of genres or whatnot, styles.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's something about this project in particular that sort of scratches that hard to categorize itch. Like, you've created something, like I'm looking at, when I think of the sort of biographical info about the record, mm-hmm. There's terms like, in terms of genre signifiers, soul, funk, film music, yeah. You know, yeah. Jazz, funk, and mysticism is one. Combines jazz, funk, and mysticism. So a lot of like, what the hell does that mean kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, I know people have conceptions of these things, and they're usually just whatever rose to the sort of mainstream masses. Mm-hmm. But for those of us who dig a bit deeper, maybe, I like, oh, well, jazz can be anything. Funk can be anything. Is that important to you on some level artistically to create things that are challenging to yourself, maybe challenge convention and norms, or is that just happenstance? Does that just happen the way you express yourself?
Yeah, I think more the latter. I'm definitely, like, with my work, I'm not seeking to set new challenges for myself. I just have had a compulsion to make music, you know, for almost 20 years now. And what comes out is what comes out. It's not, I don't try to consciously mediate, oh, now I'm going to do this. I think a lot of it comes from my deep abiding passion for music and sound, which is something that I've had since I was about 12 years old. And I'm an obsessive listener and amateur historian of, you know, certain strains of music. And I just get really animated by encountering stuff that makes me feel something vivid emotionally or imaginistically. I don't know if that's a word, but in my imagination, something is evoked by the encounter with creative, imaginative music. And that's just basically my goal, to make music that is creative, imaginative, vivid, you know, dank, you know, something that occupies space in your mind and becomes almost like a 3D object. So I don't know that I'm consciously trying to, it's not like I'm making a gumbo and being like, ooh, a little bit of soul, a little bit of funk. Ooh, let's put a little bit of banjo, you know, like.
No, I don't think you are. Yeah, no, I think I understand where you're coming from with it. It's just interesting. I mean, I have noticed over the last 10, 15 years, there's this explosion in genre signifiers. Yeah. I mean, you just used the term dank, which has sort of emerged. I don't mean to sound like an old man here. I don't want to sound like an old, out of touch linguistics professor, but you use the term dank, and that's something that's sort of new.
Yeah.
And I haven't really heard it. Is that a musical application as well? Like, I've heard it applied for, you know, dank memes or dank. Yeah. Like, what does that even mean? But actually, let me ask you that, young man. What does dank mean, Max? What do you think that means?
I think it comes about trying to diagnose the production of media more so than the content of it. You know, everything is so highly aestheticized in how we have cataloged all of human expression so minutely on the internet that just about everything possesses an aesthetic of its own. And for me, like, that means sort of like the detritus of the commercial music industry. In other words, stuff that didn't make it to that echelon, but was sort of like cast by the wayside in the course of the music industry sort of being turned over. So that's like people who were aspiring to be commercial musicians and may not have made it, or were kind of on a lower tier financially or economically speaking in that world. But the result is like recordings that have a degraded fidelity or just like a moody or warped or ambient quality that doesn't have to do with the songwriting, the chords and the words necessarily, but has to do with the atmosphere. So that's how I employ that word, is to try and describe the fact that what I'm trying to do with these records, sort of from the production perspective, is create something that feels like lived in and woozy and like it's a vibe that was in the room that just happened to be captured, and the sort of magic of like capturing spontaneity, capturing like 7, 8, 9, if you include the engineers and producers, human beings in a building on this day. This is the gunk that we scraped off the floor. I don't know if that's a good descriptor, but
I appreciate that, and I appreciate that this was a contemporary record, but it's funny that as we talk about categorization, what do you make of kind of temporal pigeonholing? Because there are instances where people will say, oh, you know, that ensemble is a jazz funk ensemble, but the other people will weirdly say, oh, and I might have done this once, by the way, and I apologize if I did, oh, that's a very 1970s sort of sound. What the hell does that mean? The whole decade? How can it sound like a whole decade? Do you remember what happened in the 70s?
Yeah.
So what do you make of that? Like, I feel like, because I do feel like we're in a zone. Ironically, we started this conversation about, you know, internet consumption. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there are children of the internet who have access to every sound, everything that has been ever made. And so that informs their creative process in a way that appeals to me, because as a young person, I also was like, I'm going to find the jazz records. I'm going to find the punk records. I'm going to find the hip-hop records and dig deep into all of this stuff. But the internet has really blown that out of the water. Like, I mean, everyone is sort of meant to be a generalist and have all of that information inspire them or influence what they, how they live, what they make. So is this potentially is this ensemble potentially arriving at a time that's sort of where time is sort of flat, a flat circle, and we're not are we over that whole, like, that's a 1970s sounding band. Are we over that stuff by now?
I think we're going to have to be, because the internet has precluded us from finding new sort of aesthetic palettes to communicate with. You know, I think that there was a sort of technological function where having reduced access to knowing about the entirety of the history of music, not being able to unpack that history, like, over the course of one night using Wikipedia, AllMusic, LimeWire, Spotify, what have you, made it so that people made more idiosyncratic choices and were informed sort of by the limited sort of technological evolution that was happening. Oh, this keyboard just came out. Let's see what it sounds like combined with what's on the radio this week. You know, what's on the radio this week? What radio? Everyone is a walking radio station of their own.
Yeah.
With Spotify and everything like that. So I just think we are at a place where we are precluded from having things that signify a contemporary flavor beyond the fact that every band sounds like a replica of, you know, a 6 month period from 30 years ago from different countries, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
That is the signifier of now. So if we're going to engage with culture that's happening contemporaneously, I think we have to get over this obsession that I think a lot of critics have with diagnosing exactly that 6 month period that you happen to be inspired by. And let's find the artists that, okay, yeah, they're inspired by a certain production aesthetic that you can diagnose to a time and place that happened many years ago. But who among the contemporary crop of artists are using that as a jumping off point, having that as a aesthetic thing to convey content that is contemporary? And that's what I'm trying to make happen with the badge thing. And I think that there's sort of symbiosis with the members, other than myself, in badge, where, yeah, we all love music from the 70s. It would be a complete lie to say that we're not inspired by that mode of production. But I think what I'm trying to communicate personally is like the idiosyncrasy of my writer's voice. I don't think that the melodies and the chords that I'm coming up with and stringing together and those sequences, I don't think you can attribute them to something that has already happened. Similarly with the lyrics, like, I'm writing about my experience in the lyrical content as a person living in 2020.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot that's very contemporary about music, which signifies past modes of production. And with music, you know, it's difficult because it's not just the content, which could be communicated with sheet music of here's the words, here's the melodies, here's the chords. Like, music also conveys an atmosphere, like I was saying earlier, the sort of production of it. So it can't, I think, like, literature may have it a little bit more easily because it's more of an interpretive form. So people aren't saying, oh, the novel hasn't evolved in 100 years. I mean, I'm sure certain strains of literary criticism have been saying that. But I think music is a form that conveys, it's a little more literal in a certain sense, in that it's conveying substance, but it's also conveying this sort of temporal quality that comes along with the substance. Well,
it does, because you invoked novels, and yes, there have been advancements in the presentation of literary works and the way they feel in your hands or the way they look on your screens. Mm-hmm. Music is very much, or it has been, I think, until recently, it can be very connected to the time it was captured, and in a way that I don't know that other art forms. I mean, I think there are many art forms that are similar. Film, certainly, a film from the 70s or 80s or 90s will look different because technology has advanced. But, like, music is among the prime examples where, like, if you follow a legacy artist, you know that their records from the 80s are going to sound a little different because technology changed.
Yeah.
And you know their records from the... they're going to sound different than the records from the 70s. Like, a 10-year... 75 and 85, totally same artist, totally different sound. And it's a lot to do with sort of stuff they have no control over. I booked the studio. The studio, I found out they replaced all their gear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now the thing that I made 10 years ago sounds a bit different. I do feel like with the democratization of technology, we're going to have a harder time saying that Max Turnbull had a bad 2020s, because you can tell by the fidelity of the record he made. You know, I thought the way I'm sort of referencing, you know, people like Neil Young or Bob Dylan, where you're like, they had kind of a rough time during that one period where technology was in the middle of figuring itself out. But now, like with home recording and you know, so much DIY stuff and studios also going back and forth between, do I just go Pro Tools? Do I have go all analog? It's sort of weird. So when I say time is kind of fucked up in terms of music, that's the kind of stuff that I think is informing that. It's not even the band you have and the music you're making. It's the way it was captured and the way, you know, as you may know, I've ordered all your records. And so I'm listening to them on vinyl, and that's going to affect my memory of it and my, you know, my experience with it as well. I can't handle the, like, this is music I don't want to just, you know, relegate to some MP3. I want to get the record and put it on. So all of this to say, and this is a lot of stuff, I don't know where I'm going with it, but there's a lot about time that I think is sort of informing Badge. And that's all I'm getting at. I don't have a handle. I'm going to work on this essay for a master's thesis at some point. But do you see where I'm coming from? There's just a lot of factors that kind of define where a record like Self Help is going to live in terms of its legacy, in terms of its history. Like, in 20 years, am I going to put on a Badge record and be like, well, that was clearly recorded in 1972. Is that possible? Is that something I might do?
I don't know. I feel that we're sort of evolving past how we've been consuming music for the last, well, I don't know. It would be disingenuous to say 40 years, because the way people have consumed music has been different over each of those decades. But we kind of have this conception that if a record is great, you know, it won't get its due. It's like true kind of contextualizing due till 20 years hence, say. Or certain records that come out now that are mainstream and are acclaimed will get taken down a couple notch in 20 years. I think we're kind of likely to evolve past that to a degree, just because I think the place that music occupies in the culture is really shifting.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I feel almost like the cultural aura that you had, that you could acquire by being in a band, say in 20, 30 years ago, is now like if you have a podcast and your podcast is sort of projecting some kind of like ideology or something like that. Or like,
well, it's a contemporary feeling it's expressing. Like we're talking about the here and now. And I think music does that too. Like I think reading the back of a John Coltrane record and knowing when and where it was made, because of my knowledge of history or whatever, like that's going to inform, oh, well, clearly that was in the air when these guys got together and went into a room together like that. And in your case, like, I don't exactly know when this record was made, but me, that's just how I process music a little bit. Oh, they made it right after such and such happened. That must have been an interesting vibe in the room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I do agree that there has been a sort of stagnation creatively in a lot of music, and we can diagnose it from the fact that people do sound precisely like, you know, they're in a post-punk band from Manchester in 1979. You know, like, there's just sort of an approach to one's musical aesthetic that's very minute and particular. I agree with that. But I think there, on the other end of it, because music is interpretive, there's been a stagnation in how people who are listening to it are receiving that information. And I think on both ends, it's like the internet, once again, is sort of mediating these experiences. It's mediating the experience of trying to be a creator in that it's forcing us to digest way more music of a much greater diversity than other creators in previous eras had to. And then as a listener, too, or as a critic, you're consuming it in such a way that's less like emotionally interpretive, and I think more to do with textualizing and being able to say, oh, well, they like this, or this is related to that, and being able to playlist it appropriately or something like that. So I just think the way that we're interacting with music, both as creators and consumers, is shifting and will continue to shift. And I think that's it's kind of a technological process at this point, which I find frustrating because I think music is among the most humane of substances that we can create and consume.
No, I agree with you, and I don't want to dive too much deeper down this hole, but as you were speaking, I was just thinking about this. Tell me what you make of this. And then I do want to ask you about the lyrics. You mentioned sort of music is interpretive, and you had invoked your own lyric writing. So I want to ask about the voices that have now found their way into the Badge universe, because my recollection was that, I guess it was never always only instrumental, but I do in my head, I'm like, oh, that's Max's instrumental band. And then a voice comes on. I'm like, no, wait, that's not true. Anyway, I want to get to that in a moment. But one thing you said there sparked some thoughts in me about the internet and technology and on a different level, in that there was a time in the not so distant past where we were all, our parents probably more than we, but maybe me, we were living our lives. And if something came on the radio or was on the TV and you didn't capture it, it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't relive the fashion over and over again. You evolved and you didn't really even notice it. You just changed and changed and changed because you weren't staring at your past 5 years ago always in your face. Like, it just wasn't accessible. Mm-hmm. And all I wanted to get at here is, because we live in an on-demand culture now where you don't miss anything, I feel like, I don't know, like, has this maybe stifled our ability to kind of evolve a little bit, because we are inundated, or have the ability anyway, to access our most recent past, our glory days. You know, I mean, as a kid who grew up in the 90s and used to tape everything off the TV that I thought was interesting, now I just YouTube it and it's there, and anyone can do that. And so I guess I just wonder temporarily what this means, if we're just constantly have this accessible archive to historical artifacts that aren't even that substantial. Like, it's one thing, or maybe that's arguable too. Like, it's cool for me to be able to be like Sonic Youth, David Letterman, 1994 on YouTube and get it. That's cool. But I also am like, as a kid, I had to be that person. And
how much cooler would it be if you were channel surfing one night and you found that that was on and you stumbled across it just, you know, spontaneously? I think it would mean that much more to you than having the ability to see it on command.
That's what I mean. I feel like the on-demand aspect of this has made us, you see it driving, I do anyway, I see it in the way people behave. There's a kind of impatience. If I don't get something now, I get everything now. I get everything I want now. I don't have to wait for anything. And I do think that's sort of fucking with our concept of time. As I'm speaking to you, we're in the midst of a pandemic where time is mostly stopped. So I just have been thinking a lot about time lately. And I just want to lay that on you too, because I feel like there's something going on there that maybe you and I can't really speak to, but I'm sure our parents can. Oh, yeah. Something happened. It was done. We moved on. You guys, you can do a full deep, you can spend your afternoon being like, oh, I'm interested in, you know, the weather report. Well, there's your day. I'm going to learn all about the weather report and watch all of their live footage. And I'm going to learn all about them. And then you're just in this weather report zone. And on the one hand, I think that's cool. On the other, I'm like, how does that impact us moving forward? So I don't even have a question here. It's just an observation.
I think if you were to like sort of monitor what it was like to listen to the radio, you know, from 1940 to 1990, say, you would find it really kind of embodying that famous Heraclitus quote, you can't step into the same river twice. Where now I think the internet is actually providing this sort of eerie quality where you can step into the same river twice. And that has created this sort of weird cultural stagnation, which is why I think it's important to think more about the substance of music, because I think there's a lot of people who are recreating old music and including the aesthetic and the substance. But I think that there are people who are recreating certain textures, but are doing it in a way that incorporates substance that's contemporary. So I think that's, as listeners, it's important to make that distinction. And I think critics could possibly do a better job of diagnosing that in certain instances. And then I think the other key to it is just all of us need to really moderate how much we are willing to have our lives be mediated by the internet, because I think you're right. It plays tricks with our perception of time, and time is all that we really possess. So
yeah, I just feel like if everything that used to be frozen in history was sort of deemed to be, you know, necessary. I don't know. I'm on, this is a new spitball theory that I haven't really figured it out. I just, as we were talking, it just occurred to me, but like, we are in a weird zone where everything is sort of historical in that it's captured and it sort of is given this importance that some of it shouldn't have. Like, my son is obsessed with watching videos of people play Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
He's just obsessed with it. And it's just guys screaming as you're watching them play the game instead of playing the game. He says he learns from it, and he does. I know he does, but I mean, and he learns how to play the game, but just like, there's parts of me that I'm like, I'm not a Luddite. I like technology. I like the internet, but it is just weird. It's just weird. And it's sort of fucking with our sense of time and place, really. Like, that's what I mean. Music. I think you probably appreciate a record from the 60s or 70s because of that fact alone. Oh, they made this 40, 50 years ago, and in the midst of something that was going on. I'm sure that informs how you even consume those records, right?
Yeah. I think just part of it is the sort of instant history that you're talking about. I don't know. I think part of the historical process should be sort of working through things, giving them the time and space to evolve. Whereas now everything is immediately documented, immediately posted, and we have this illusion that it's been worked through, you know? I think we see this with the news cycle, where like, it seems like we've had 60 of the biggest news stories just consecutively in the last like 9 months, and yet we can't remember the ones that happened in March, April, May, June, July, you know? Because we have this instant historical documentation process that doesn't allow for things to kind of unfold in something that has more of an affinity for how humans process time. So I don't know. Yeah, I agree. I think we are outsmarting ourselves and
maybe
living diminished lives as a result of how technologically entwined we are. I realize I didn't really answer your last question, but that was just more musings on the nature and history of time.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't even remember what my question was. Sorry, they were vague temporal rants.
Yeah,
I went on as though I was arguing with Doc Brown about his DeLorean and telling him he should put it away. It was weird. But anyway, no, I appreciate the response and engagement with this stuff. Now, I did want to ask about the voices and the incorporation of voices. Mm-hmm. In Badge. So am I right? Did it start out as, I don't know if I'm right, because as I recall, there have been voices the whole time on certain pieces, right?
Yeah. So this is like our third. We did a record, a 12-inch, and then Self Help is the second record. I guess the thing in between is sort of an EP, although it's almost as long as the first record. And everything has had vocals, but the first two only had one vocal featuring track. And so, you know, that made up 2 minutes of the running time of a half hour thing. Whereas this record has three vocal featuring songs. And the vocals and the lyrics, I think, just occupy a little bit more space than they have on our prior releases.
Okay, so what is it about? Because as I recall, there'd be like a long instrumental piece, and then there would be like a kind of not as many vocals as you would like. If a piece was like 8 minutes, like you said, there'd be a little bit of vocals. What does that say about what you're trying to convey there? Why the incorporation of the voice, but also the mm-hmm. minimization of the voice on some level? What does that mean?
I think I was trying to explore a form where the vocal appearances could sort of have a similar profile to like a jazz soloist on a song, you know?
Yeah.
They're there, but they're in and out a little bit. And when they're there, they shine and it's a feature. And then they kind of get out of the way and let the music sort of communicate to the listener. I think that was kind of my idea conceptually about it.
Okay.
I say get out of the way, I don't mean to demean any of them, because we just have just an embarrassment of riches as far as the people who sang on this album. They're all so tremendous.
Yeah. Speaking of which, can you kind of outline who's on this record? And if you want to highlight anyone else who you've worked with in the past, I'm happy to hear that too. But can you talk about that?
Yeah. So we have James Bailey returning to collaborate with us. We did a great song called Undressed in Solitude on the first record, which was sort of a highlight of the catalog, I think. So that was sort of a no-brainer to see if he would come back into the studio. And then Meg of US Girls, my wife, sings on one song, a duet with Dorothea Paz, who's a tremendous singer-songwriter from Toronto who was sort of in the last wave of US Girls. We were supposed to go on tour in end of March. You can probably guess how that turned out. But
yeah.
We did some work together, and I've been mixing her album too. So just someone who I was in the studio with a whole bunch and who's kind of got a voice like a synthesizer. You know, she is very expressive and you can sort of like plug in the coordinates and it comes out exact. She's just a remarkable singer. So having Meg and her on one song was kind of fun because Meg is also quite capable as a singer, but she's so character oriented with her vocal approach. So I like the sort of contrast of their styles for the one song, Sing a Silent Gospel, that they share. And then Jennifer Castle, you know, was the first person whom I wanted to collaborate with, who is sort of outside of the circle of people that I had worked with musically before. I thought it might be a long shot, but, you know, we're friendly, a lot of mutual friends, and I've hung out at concerts and stuff in the past, and I'm a huge fan of her work and her music, her voice, her aura, just everything about her. So,
me too, if I might say me as well.
Anyone who knows anything about music in Canada on a contemporary level basically has her among their favorite singers and songwriters, I think.
It's true.
Just so tremendous. So deeply, deeply humbling for me to reach out to her and have that be, have some interest reciprocated there.
So you had said earlier that, you know, as a lyric writer, you'd mentioned that you've been writing lyrics. So are you conceiving of the lyrics for these singers, or are they bringing in their own ideas?
I wrote the lyrics for the album. James, the process with the song that James was on, was that I gave him the track, the instrumental, and he, did a scratch vocal where he just kind of came up with whatever was coming to mind and mostly just was, improvising melodies. And, I took that and wrote words to, his syncopation and, his melodic ideas. So, he co-wrote that song in that respect. The other songs, I wrote the melodies as well as the lyrics, and sort of cast the singers where I felt their voices would shine.
That's pretty fun. That's cool. I'm glad you got the opportunity to work with so many great people in that regard. That must be fun on some level too. I'm trying to think. It must be. I've talked to lots of people who do this. What is it like to write a song and then give it to someone else to sing? I mean, I know that sounds probably kind of silly, but I assume you kind of sung the song to yourself as you wrote the lyrics, and then you're handing it over to someone else. Like, what is it like to have someone interpret your words in such a way?
It's very easy when the people are leagues and leagues better than you at this activity. I find it very easy and thrilling to make something that would be warbled in an off-kilter way by me completely come to life and be this stunning, beautiful creation. I think that comes back a little bit to, like, this band is just me sort of acknowledging where exactly is my skill set in music. And I discovered over doing a lot of projects that my skill is as a writer and as a lyricist to a degree, and really primarily as a producer. So let me do those things and do them really well, and then give the keys to people who are very, very skilled and creative artists in their own respect. So I don't know. It's just a blessing to have people who are so good at playing music and so good at singing deliver stuff which has its genesis in my imagination and then is transformed by their interpretation.
Now, do you have any perspective on the lyrics you have conceived of for this record in terms of maybe potential themes, or is there anything about what you wrote that took a different sort of twist when you heard how people were kind of phrasing what you wrote and maybe attacking the songs on an emotive level? Can you speak to those things? I guess I'm asking, you know, what do these songs mean in a sense? But I want to try to get at it from both your intent as a lyricist, maybe, and then also, yeah, what you made of what they did to what your guest vocalist sort of did to the songs, if you will.
I guess, yeah, between this record and the last one, I became a meditator. And I think that was probably the biggest influence on the lyric writing process. I think a commonality between all of the songs that have lyrics is that they are expressing things to do with a sort of meditative state of mind and expressing a desire to move consciousness in such a way where one can be put in touch with a feeling of boundlessness, sort of removing the highly individualized sense of oneself as being this very rigid commodity. Just being inspired by that process and the process of trying to move one's consciousness, have a looser sort of state of mind where it concerns one's temporality or corporality. And then as far as people singing that stuff, it's interesting, you know, because you have these studio experiences where you're not communicating to people what I just communicated to you. You're just saying, well, here's the lyrics, here's the melodies, and whatever your rapport is as friends or collaborators. And then they interpret these things without having to be explicit about what the meaning is. And that's so much a part of what I'm trying to do, is just grant people the leeway to interpret my conception of the moods that I'd like to evoke and that we'd like to evoke as a group. So yeah, I think that I'm so pleased with all of the vocal contributions. I don't know if I have like tremendous insights other than just feeling really lucky about the people who sang and how vividly those songs came to life. And just, you know, I have a curiosity about what those words meant to those people, particularly in the moment they were singing them. But that's something that's left for me to speculate on.
I'm gathering that in sort of being inspired by your interest in meditation, that the title itself, Self-Help, maybe speaks to that, this notion of just being sort of taking care of yourself, self-care, if you will. Is that fair, or is that too heavy-handed?
I think like titles have a kind of mysterious chemistry with the people who come up with them, you know, just you toss words around in your brain and all of a sudden, oh wow, that one really speaks to what we're trying to create. I kind of liked the contrast of self-help being two words that people have very distinct associations with. It sort of being like a genre of thought that is very well defined. And for what we were trying to create with this record and my ideas lyrically, having some commonalities with that as a sort of defined mode of thought, but then other things that are completely counter or sort of in a weird harmony with that idea, and sort of playing off that notion in a way that's sort of remixing it. Huh. I'm not I'm not an advocate for self-care in a super in like the kind of conventional sense that I think it's often like tweeted about or something like that. But I do feel that the dilution of one's identity is something that can kind of counterintuitively inform a really positive self-identification. And without saying too much more about it, that's for me a large thematic motif of the album.
Well, I appreciate your candor here, Max, and I also appreciate that you might want to leave some things open to interpretation, so I'm not going to press you further on that. We are in a zone, I'm gathering, as a musician, as a musician who normally tours live, plays live, mm-hmm. and you alluded to this earlier with the U.S. Girls, I assume yeah. you're kind of grounded at the moment, given all that's going on. Yes. So I guess I wonder, you know, you're on the show, you're talking about this record, but what's sort of next for Badge or for you? Do you have plans at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I've been making use of the boundless free time to kind of wrap up a number of projects. So I've got a lot of music that I think is going to be ready to come out next year. Some of it Badge Epic Ensemble related, and some other things which some other musical identities which haven't yet popped to the surface of a wider consciousness.
Okay.
So yeah, just really leaning into the ability to produce music right now. And I think that's where my greatest affinity is. It's even less with touring than it is with producing new music. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, it's almost, I know I've talked to a few musicians who have sort of said, yeah, the lack of income sucks, but I kind of like being at home. I kind of like not having to be on the road on some level. So
yeah,
that seems to be common. So if people want to learn more about you or Badge or this record, where would you send them online? I know you don't like the internet. No, I'm just kidding. I know you do. Where would you like to send people to learn more about your work?
Google.ca would be a good place to start. And then the name of the group is Badge, B-A-D-G-E, Epic, E-P-O-Q-U-E, Ensemble. If you Google that, I'm sure the resources will come up. We're okay. on Spotify, we're on Bandcamp. I have a Instagram and a Twitter and, you know, the label Telephone Explosion has a website. So, yeah. If you want to find it, it's easily found.
Okay. Yeah, the label is Telephone Explosion Records. Okay. Now, Max, if we can go out on a song,
yeah.
a single song, I presume, from this new self-help album, do you mind picking one for us? And if so, why did you pick the one you're going to tell us about?
Sure. Let's pick The Sound Where My Head Was. I think that's the title.
That's right. The Sound Where My Head Was. That's an evocative and vivid title in many ways. Why did you choose that one?
I chose that one because it's instrumental and I think exemplifies like the approach to mood and kind of colliding and combining and recombining moods and aesthetics that I think we try to do as a group. And because I think it's a song that probably wouldn't get played on the radio or on a podcast otherwise. So I wouldn't mind exposing people to it.
Okay. All right. From their new album, Self Help, this is Badge Epic Ensemble with The Sound Where My Head Was. Max, it's always fun to chat with you, and I appreciate it, and I wish you the best luck with everything going forward.
Thanks for having me on again, Vish. It's great to chat with you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Always a great time having Max Turnbull on this show. I've lost track of how many times Max has been on the show to talk about things like his old alter ego there, Slim Twig, or Darlene Shrug, and now Badge Epic Ensemble. That was really fun. This time Max was on the 582nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available wherever it is you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple or Google or Spotify or what have you. It's there. However, if you can't find an episode of the show that you've heard about and you're looking for it and it's just not in any of those places for some reason, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on the Facebook, or you can follow the show on the Twitter. You can follow the show directly at vishcreative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. You can also follow me on Instagram at Vish Khanna. I've never really mentioned that before, but I take photos sometimes, or I take other people's photos and I put them on my Instagram. So If you like that stuff, go to @BishCon and on the Instagram. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more a month gets you access to some exclusive content, but whatever you can afford and are willing to donate to the show, that would be appreciated. I recently asked people on Twitter if they would consider donating, and somehow I lost money. You don't lose money on that deal. Like, you ask people if they'll consider donating and you get more, but I went the other way. Always a hazard. You remind people, oh yeah, I give to that Patreon. I better go in there and get rid of that, but I don't want that. Please don't do that. Go to patreon.com/creativecontrol and make a flexible monthly donation today. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com for their support of the show. You can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists at that website. Also, thanks to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Will I ever get back to any of those places again from here in Edmonton, Alberta? I don't know. I really don't. I hope they still exist when I get back there, because I miss them. And you, if you're near any of those places, I would go. They're great. So do that. Thanks, as always, to my dear pal Jim Guthrie. He lends me some music for the show, and you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And that's pretty much it. I want to thank you for listening to this episode with Max. I hope you liked it, and I hope you'll listen to Self Help by Badge Epic Ensemble. And I also hope you'll tell your friends to subscribe to this podcast or follow the podcast. Or don't tell them to subscribe to it. That's too much. Just ask them to listen to it. If they like it, they'll figure out how to subscribe to it or follow it. But still, recommend the show and tell your friends and tell your parents about the show. And I gotta go. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.